The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to the 2017 Internal Medicine Board Review Course, sponsored by the American College of Osteopathic Internists. The course was held March 22nd through 26th, 2017, at the JW Marriott Las Vegas Resort and Spa. The course featured nationally known speakers presenting a wide variety of topics of interest to the internist preparing for certification or recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Headaches, motor neuron disorders, and amyotrophies is presented by Dr. Scott Spradlin.
Okay, let's take a stroll through headaches, motor disorders, and amyotrophies. So, board question. 28-year-old female, throbbing, unilateral headache, 3 times a month. Comes on suddenly, persists for a couple days. What type of headache is it? Is it a migraine with aura? Is it a migraine without? Tension type headache or a cluster headache? So much like the first one, there are some keywords in here. Keywords in here is throbbing, unilateral. Answer, it's a cluster headache. Okay, so let's talk about some migraines. Migraines are unilateral, they're intermittent, and they're throbbing. They last anywhere from 4 hours to multiple days. There's usually some form of aura around it, light sensitivity, sound sensitivity, and are usually associated with some form of prodrome. And they can have scotomas and vision disturbances. There are usually triggers, and each person is unique and different. It can come from food to odor to even just changes in climate. There is an acephalic migraine, and it's an abnormal transient dysfunction, and they have no pain. And not right for a board question, but it's interesting for all the work you do when you're not taking a board question. Person comes in, has really scattered vision in both eyes, driving down the road. They walk into your office and say, "Scared me to death." I've had that happen to me 3 times in practice. And all 3 of the times I heard that story. And they didn't have any numbness, tingling, no other symptoms. Sure, I had people with vision problems with other things, but that was it. And it really started like they were looking through a kaleidoscope. That was an acephalic migraine. So let's look at the classifications of headache. So we have a migraine, we have tension headaches, cluster headaches that we just saw an example of, coital headaches, post-traumatic, temporal arteritis. Boards love temporal arteritis, pseudotumor cerebri, and thalamic. So treatment for migraines are going to be the serotonin agonists. And I would think for board purposes, they're not going to ask you to pick between them. Non-steroidals, ergotamine, dopamine antagonists, rarely recommended use of narcotics. You go find that in a lot of pain, as you all know, from either your CME or practice. And in a severe situation, meaning a severe resistant migraine headache, that you would want to admit them and administer DHE intravenously. One of the new changes is that for chronic ongoing migraines is the use of botulinum toxin A. So prophylactic treatment is usually preferred, if tolerated, to keep once you've diagnosed a migraine in line. The classics for that's going to be a beta blocker, to a lesser degree, tricyclics, and then then either Depakote or possibly Topamax. So let's talk about cluster headaches. Cluster headaches occur daily for weeks, then stop. For a board question, this is going to be a person who wakes up in the morning, severe headache. They're going to be an ice pick type feeling. And it is usually at higher risk right after REM sleep. And she had sleep yesterday in early AM. It's the worst pain they've ever had. It peaks in about 5 or 10 minutes to the point they think that that's where they end up going. That's why they come to the emergency room or call you. And then it throbs kind of in a decrescendo for 2 hours. There can be associated neurological signs like a Horner syndrome. And usually this, the classic demographic person that's going to get this is a male who smokes and drinks, who's tall, thin, and hazel eye color, but not exclusive. Treatment for that are going to be the 5-HT1 receptor agonists, the triptans. Oxygen is one that you can easily give in a good test question. Person comes in with the worst headache of their life. They come into the emergency room, and they said, you know, that doctor was wonderful because whatever he did to me, I felt really, really good. And you look and you go, he sent him home with Motrin. Well, what the patient forgot to tell you, and what you probably don't know yet because you don't have the record or you're not able to access it, is that they strapped oxygen on them when they come to the emergency room, and all at once that was the kicker. Lidocaine intranasal drops can be used, corticosteroids, and of course, prophylactic treatment for this is really calcium channel blockers. So let's look at tension headaches. Tension headaches, although it's a medical diagnosis, it's also a in the DSM. It's chronic muscle contraction. It's daily. It's usually bilateral. There's a tight band feeling. And the key word here, if they're having you look for a tension headache, and even when you're talking to the patients, is really non-throbbing, where the throbbing is what differentiates kind of the cluster. Treatments for that are non-steroidals, muscle relaxants, tricyclics, and beta blockers to try to control some of the tension and anxiety. Much different use for the beta blocker in a tension headache than it is in a migraine. So there's some other headaches that we want to go through very quickly here because they're fair game. Coital headaches are headaches that result as a part of sexual interactions. They're usually benign. It does become a problem if people encounter them continuously, and usually a beta blocker or endomethacin is a good treatment for that. Post-traumatic vascular headaches, it's usually comes after an acute trauma. It's very similar to migraine and be treated like a migraine, come and go. Temporal arteritis. You probably heard this in at least 2 or 3 lectures this week. Key thing here, sudden onset, temporal artery tenderness, elevated SED rate, it's usually greater than 60, and the age is greater than 55. The board question is not so much for you finding the temporal arteritis, as they'll say, what do you do next? And it'll have biopsy or steroids. The treatment is that you treat with the steroids and do the biopsy whenever you can get it scheduled, if you think that's where it's at. Pseudotumor cerebri. Classic one for that's going to be a relatively heavy premenopausal woman. There's going to be associated diplopia and headache with vision loss. So for a test question like that, they would need to show you a fundus exam with papilledema. So you can see that from the elevated pressure of the CSF. These people have very elevated CSF, greater than about 250 millimeters of mercury. And the treatment for that are diuretics and steroids. Thalamic, that we'll talk about a little bit later when we get into stroke, but it's a headache that you don't necessarily know the person has because they're unable to tell you. Because usually people that have had thalamic infarcts have an intensive pain and are unable to communicate it. And one of the key things here is that even though you have the neurological symptoms, that this headache is so severe and debilitating that you have to proactively treat that to control the pain so that the patient can improve. So quick run through headaches. Now let's talk about some of the motor disorders. And tagging on to Dr. Hasty here, you'll see some recurrent themes here. That's probably for a reason. Parkinson's disease, it's a clinical diagnosis solely. So the signs and symptoms of that, you'll have resting tremor, rigidity, retarded movement, and loss of postural reflexes. Of course, the reason for that is a decrease in dopamine-producing cells in the substantia nigra section of the brain. So, for a board question, you'll get a person with shuffle gait, stiff arms. How do you differentiate that? Well, this chart does a pretty good job. So if you're seeing a tremor and presenting Parkinson's, it's going to be more asymmetric resting tremor. Because if you see symmetric tremors, I want you to be thinking about essential tremor as being the culprit. So for clumsy and weak limb, in Parkinson's, it's going to be a bradykinesia. As you pull that arm down, it's going to be slow to bring down. Whereas in a carpal tunnel or one of the other neuropathies we kind of talked about this morning, and stroke, there is going to be flaccidity or decreased movement in that. And there may be a limb issue, but it's not going to be the same. So you're going to have altered reflexes, sensation and strength if it's either carpal tunnel or stroke. So that's how you'll, that would be the only, that's how you would differentiate that. From the standpoint of the limb for rigidity, and differentiating that from musculoskeletal symptoms, Parkinson's patients do not have pain with movement. So on a board question, that would, if you hear pain with movement, just go, how are you going to differentiate? And then gait. There's always people shuffling, so let's talk about that. Asymmetric slowness with Parkinson's. Shuffling, reduced arm swing, minimal or no imbalance. Whereas if we have ischemic lesions in the brain, or we have hydrocephalus, or we have musculoskeletal disorders, we will have that symmetric, we will have symmetric shuffling. We will continue to have an arm swing, where Parkinson's patients don't have that arm swing. You'll have a wide base gait instead of that narrow base, and prominent imbalance and limited movement at the knee and hip. Treatment for Parkinson's is going to be to increase the dopamine. It's either going to be a Sinemet or one of the other agents, and they are vast. The key thing is if you're resistant to multiple treatments and combinations of, whether it's Requip or et cetera, opportunities are for either deep brain stimulation and in some instances, surgery. This is a little bit of a chart that shows you the medications. Just quickly peruse through that, and I'm going to spend a lot of time on it. I think you probably already know it, but it's worth one quick glance. Let's talk about a condition that kind of looks like Parkinson's, because we talked about how we differentiate Parkinson's from the common things. But here's one called progressive supranuclear palsy. It's very similar to Parkinson's. There's an erect posture. There's a hyperextension of the neck. There is no tremor. And they have vertical ophthalmoplegia, meaning they can't look up or down. And it's a progressive disease that over the course of a couple of years, they're unable to walk or function, and there is no treatment. So for a board exam question, you see a person in their 70s that comes along, looks like Parkinson's. They'd have to give you the vertical ophthalmoplegia with the hyperextension of the neck with progression. And in that case, that's where you would differentiate it from the Parkinson's, but it also would make you not pick Sinemet as a treatment. Huntington's chorea, it's inherited, autosomal dominant, you just heard a minute ago. Heard about the hemibolismus, the rigidity and the dystonia. CTs will show a bulge of the caudate nucleus and large ventricles. The treatment for that's going to be tetrabenazine or amantadine or riluzole. So people have been using riluzole to help try to control that. And most importantly, just to drive that point home, once that diagnosis is made, it's important for us to have genetic counseling for the entire family. Benign tremor, talked about that a minute ago. It's not to be confused with a normal tremor. It's called essential tremor. It's about 7 hertz When you look at that tremor, engage it. It's autosomal dominant. Treatment for that's gonna be beta blockers. It's gonna be symmetrical. And you sat there and it's this big deal to a person that has it. It affects people when they're in their jobs, and they are very sensitive around trying to control that. Tardive dyskinesia, it's the effect of long-term antipsychotics. So you get a board question, person's been on multiple psychotics, comes in, has got a whole bunch of issues with abnormal movements of the lips, tongue, face, and neck. Concern of the family. It's really exchanging the dopamine agonist antipsychotic. It's a side effect. Neuroleptic malignant syndrome. It's a response to antipsychotics too. There's a dopamine receptor blockade. If it's a anesthesiological emergency, they see this quite frequently when they're doing anesthesia. You could be called yourself. Many of you probably have. People have very high temperatures. This is not just 101, 102. These people are 106. They're on fire. There is rigidity. There's an increased CK. Makes sense from that type of metabolic activity and response. They'll have an altered mental status. Acute treatment is support, hemodynamic support, remove those drugs, and in many instances, use other drugs to try to control the symptomatology until that has subsided. Tic de la Rue, it's a hemifacial spasm. There's pain associated with it, and that's why it's the trigeminal neuralgia. 80% of them are affecting the basal artery, affecting the facial nerve. And the treatment for that is carmazine. Tegretol is going to be your treatment there. One of the most important things is to find out if there's a multi-effect or single effect of the nerve. But either way, this can be manageable. The pain is usually the driver. Gilles de la Tourette, the treatment for that is going to be neuroleptics with either Risperdal or the Geodon. Torticollis, outside of manipulative therapy that should be on there as well, botulinum toxin is a treatment. Meg syndrome, I put that on there more so because it has found its way, not on the on the research, but on the initials. It's a bilateral blepharospasm with lip and mouth movement. And then Creutzfeldt-Jakob is one that you hear about ever so often in USA Today or in the press. It's quite a disclaimer to put on or a distractor for a test question. And they have myoclonus with dementia. Brain biopsy is how you get to the diagnosis. There's no treatment. And it usually, just like Dr. Blackburn drives in, requires someone that has either done a travel and gone to another country and ate different cuisine that they were unaware of and been contaminated. Seizures. As you know, it's an excessive abnormal discharge of electrical activity in the CNS. There's two types. There's going to be partial and generalized. Partial seizures are known as focal or local seizures. The seizure activity occurs usually in a specific area within the brain. There's a sensory phenomenon. There's autonomic manifestation and psychic manifestations. The generalized seizures are usually divided into two types, absence and myoclonic. Absence could be sudden, brief motor, blank stare, a little bit of unconsciousness, not quite there. Where myotonic is going to be sudden, there's going to be uncontrollable jerking and myotonic activity or muscle movement. There'll be associated unconsciousness as well, and then confusion with that classic postictal. So that's how you would differentiate myoclonic from the absence in a non-witnessed seizure. So tonic-clonic seizures are grand mal, may or may not have an aura. Sudden onset of consciousness, the tonic phase is that abrupt increase in muscle tone and contraction, and the clonic is the rhythmic relaxation of the muscle contraction. Status epilepticus is going to be the continuous seizures. They're not going to ask you to define the difference with that. It'll be sustained. And controversially, you can have a lot of back and forth, so don't worry about that. But it's a sustained seizures. Complex partial seizures is purposefully repetitive activities. It evolves to a secondary generalized a seizure. And these are some of the clinical features associated with each, which I glanced through as a quick read. So let's go through some of the myopathies. Go look at them in four pieces: hereditary, metabolic, inflammatory, and toxic. Workup for a myopathy is going to be, because it involves a muscle, we have to have CKs, we have to look at electrolytes, we have to look at myoglobin. Critical thing to take away is myoglobinuria is indicated by a positive urinalysis with few red blood cells, or none. CBC is inflammation rate, thyroid and liver functions, a nerve conduction, and then of course age-appropriate cancer screening. And to the point that was stressed in the last lecture, as you're working up a myopathy based on where it drives you, different tests to kind of get you to that diagnosis, whether it's looking for a lactic acidosis or other issues. For purposes of the initial board exam, these are two diseases that essentially can evolve into the internist turf. Most of these are later into their 18, 19 years, but there's two types. You've got McArdle's, which is a glycogen storage disease, and you have CPT, which is really a deficiency, which is really a lipid storage. Both of them have gene loci as a defect. The difference between these two, although they usually have myalgias and tenderness with exercise, is that with McArdle's, you have a second wind phenomenon, meaning when they stop, it goes away, and then they can go back to it, where it's actually absent in the lipid storage disease of CPT. And in McArdle's, when this actually in the acute phases of the exercise, they will have an elevated CK, where in the lipid storage disease of the CPT, it will be normal. Duchenne's muscular dystrophy. If you have one enough, you have new things that happen. It's X-linked, it's progressive weakness. It begins at age 2, borders right into the age for internal medicine. Proximal weakness is greater than distal. There's an elevated CK. And this year, boom, or actually last year, boom, we get treatment for muscular dystrophy. First time in a long time. It was unprecedented, as you all read in the news. Exondys 51 was approved for the treatment of muscular dystrophy. It's from the 51 exon defect. It's not one of the most common ones of muscular dystrophy, but very expensive drug. And that study essentially showed that anyone that is younger than the age of 14 and ambulatory and has this exon defect, that is a good treatment. Right after that, a steroid that's been around longer than I've been around, Deflazacort, it's been used in Europe forever, is now approved for treatment of muscular dystrophy with any defect. So a brand new treatment for muscular dystrophy. Not necessarily might make the boards this year, but when you have a major change like that, they're coming. Myotonic dystrophy, you saw less than 20 minutes ago. The reason I say this exists, is it was made for a board question. It's inherited, it's autosomal dominant, and it has weakness, sleep apnea, cardiac conduction defects, mitral valve prolapse, and testicular atrophy. What more could be a good internist question? And mitochondrial lactic acidosis syndromes, mitochondrial myopathy, definitely lactic acidosis. It was discussed last time. Weakness, neurological disease. Individuals have strokes usually before the age of 40 if they're fortunate enough to make it there, with the renal function and other issues, specifically kidney and liver. Thing you'll be looking for there is red ragged fibers on biopsy of the muscle. Metabolic, touch on these because we're rounding out what you heard in your endocrine lectures, is Addison's disease, particularly when fluid and electrolyte problems are present, can have a associated myopathy. Cushing's, as you heard about, will also have associated myopathies. The thyroids, whether it's hypo or hyper, and especially with the CK is elevated in the hypo and normal in the hyper, can have associated myopathies. Hyperparathyroid and Kahn syndrome have associated myopathies. The last thing I want to talk before ending this lecture is really periodic paralysis. Do I really believe there's a board question we can give on periodic paralysis? No. Is it a distractor and quite a few ones? Yes. So the best thing about periodic paralysis is that is a paralysis that can occur with around potassium, with it being normal, low, or high. And really, the normokalemic paralysis is really the most severe with a prolonged attack. These people usually feel fine between attacks, but when they have it, they have myotonia, they have residual weakness after repeated episodes. Acute hypokalemic periodic paralysis can be familial, or it can be secondary to renal GI losses. And so it's easy to weave this in and make this a reasonable solution. They'd have to really serve it up to you well, but to be able to demonstrate that. Familial periodic paralysis occurs in Caucasian males. It's dominant, and it can last as long as 36 hours. So it's pretty profound. And it usually occurs at night or in the early morning upon awakening, and can be precipitated by diet high in carbohydrates, which I happen to have. I happen to be a specialist in carbohydrate diet, and rest, rest following the exercise, or glucose and insulin. The reason I think this is just so important is because we're getting out and beginning to move as a society, and a lot of people are waking up and trying to make their life better, and this could be occurring more and more as we try to get less sedentary. Inflammatory dermatomyositis and polymyositis. Key thing here is dermatomyositis responds to glucocorticosteroids. It's proximal muscle weakness. MRIs will show an inflammatory component of those myocytes. And the EMGs will show myopathic changes consistent with inflammation. Inclusion body myositis looks just about like dermatomyositis and polymyositis. It does not respond to steroids like the prior two. The biopsy will usually show vacuole inclusions in with the eosinophils. And that's how you can determine the difference. Infections always raise a potential for myopathy. You know, Lyme's disease comes and goes. It's still out there, still conformant. You heard it even in the lecture on advanced Lyme's. Staphylococcal infections are still huge. It's been re-emphasized by ID, as you know, that it's one of the most prevalent ones, infections that come after many viruses in younger people, and we're seeing a lot of that, so there's myopathies can be associated with that. And then other associated viruses, as we discussed earlier with Guillain-Barré, around the Coxsackies and the adenos, but Epstein-Barr, cytomegalovirus, HIV, and influenza can all have associated myopathies, post-acute infection. Toxic, really the ingestion of chemicals. We saw this morning the mesalines with the arsenic poisoning can be a component, but you can also do it with other things. Alcohol can give a symmetric neuropathy. Combinations of certain medications, such as statins and fenofibrates, can lead to that. There are certain steroids that develop the myopathies, as we've heard from the other lecturers. And cocaine can have an associated myopathy, as well as some of the drugs like amiodarone and colchicine, which you'll hear a lot more about later this morning with the drug interactions and side effects. Myasthenia gravis is an order I want to touch on. It's usually associated with a thymoma. It's a motor end plate disorder. There's double vision or diplopia, and ptosis is common. How you diagnose that is with anti-acetylcholine receptor antibodies. A tensilon test when the ptosis is present is diagnostic. And the treatment for that is going to be mestinon, thymectomy. And if you're in crisis, the answer for that's going to be a plasma exchange or intravenous immunoglobulin. Lambert-Eaton, is a disease, and we alluded to it this morning, that primary malignancies can also give us neuropathies. This is associated with those cell carcinomas. It's a presynaptic peripheral nerve antibodies that causes acetylcholine release to decrease. There's proximal muscle weakness. There's dry mouth. There's hyporeflexia, especially in the lower extremities. And the treatment for that's going to be anticholinesterase agents.